Far too few people know about the terrible war and the massive famine in Sudan. We use this program to cover these issues from as many perspectives as possible, to learn about the long history behind these events, the people and groups involved, and the role that foreign governments and international organizations have played. We discuss the critical role that civil society groups have played in Sudan, bringing a form of mutual aid and support with the national government, the warring factions, and international humanitarian organizations have utterly failed. Our guests are Dr. Usman Hamdan, who is a graduate of the University of Khartoum, Sudan. He holds a PhD in forestry economics from the Dresden University of Technology. He's a longtime pro-democracy fighter and activist. Umnia Najir is a doctoral candidate in the program in Modern Thought and Literature at Stanford University, where she studies Black feminist thought and the Black radical tradition. Her poetry chapbook, Armeika, explores the experiences of the Sudanese-American diaspora and the unofficial government torture sites known as ghost houses. Speaking Out of Place is produced in collaboration with The Creative Process and is made with support from Stanford University. I alone am responsible for its content. We are so grateful to have both of you with us. So perhaps we could start with a very general description of the current crisis and then explore some of its main features and root causes. Usman, could you please begin?
Yeah, sure. Actually, just as mentioned, the situation in Sudan's war just defies short sound bites. If we need to dive deeper into this, we need to go back and see what was the background for this conflict. And I think the background has a lot to do with the revolutions that took place in 2018, 2019, that deposed the 30 years long dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir. And what happened after that? The intervention from too many regional powers and also superpowers, which derailed the revolution and instituted a transitional government. These powers enforced a civilian military partnership. People on the streets were calling for a full civilian rule. I think that was one of the main causes. This very fragile partnership between the military, which is composed of two main is constitutional military and militia. Actually, it is a paragovernmental militia. It is created by the state, and a very weak civilian component of this partnership, which were just a nominal partner in the partnership. This very fragile partnership couldn't actually continue the interim period, and conflicts have been simmering for a very long time between the two branches of the military, National Army, which is Sudanese Armed Forces staff, and the RSF. This simmering conflicts culminated in the war. Maybe Umnia can talk more about that.
Maybe I can just take us through some of the chronology. On April 15th, 2023, millions of residents in the tri-city capital of Khartoum, Bahri, and Omdurman were jolted awake by airstrikes and anti-aircraft fire and heavy artillery. We had never seen this type of fighting in the capital. There had been fighting in the peripheries, but this was completely new. And overnight, the city was transformed into an active war zone, and there were fighter jets, helicopters shaking the streets. And these sounds marked the onset of what we like to call not a civil war, but actually a counter-revolutionary war between the Sudanese Armed Forces, SAF, and the paragovernmental militia, the Rapid Support Forces. And the Western media often talks about this as if it's a civil war, but It's a clash between armed groups. Everyday civilians are actually not involved, and neither of these military groups have the support of the civilians. There's these two opposing generals, Abd al-Fattah al-Burhan, so we're going to call him al-Burhan from here on. He's the head of SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces. And then there's Mohammed Hamdan Dagalo. He's also known colloquially as Hemeti, and he's the head of the RSF. And these two men are vying for power right now in Sudan. So SAF is, like my dad said, a conscripted military force. They have about 200,000 active personnel. The RSF is a paragovernmental military, and most of the fighters are recruited from the state of Darfur, which is in the west of Sudan. It's a very big state. They have about 80,000 to 150,000 fighters, and they were originally known as the Janjaweed. Janjaweed means devils on horseback, and they earned this name in 2003 when the genocidal war began in Darfur. Because these fighters, the Janjaweed, they would come on and they would set the villages completely on fire and burn them down. So they became known as Janjaweed, or devils on horseback. And the Janjaweed has now been rebranded as the RSF. And just a couple of key points about them is that they're not a rebel movement and they're not a resistance movement. They're a legally recognized militia that's a tool of state power, and they were created by Omar al-Bashir when he became paranoid that the Sudanese armed forces would turn against him. And of course, he needs the military to maintain his military dictatorship. So he created this alternative force, and in 2017, he formally legitimized them as part of the security force. So that's only 2 years before he gets deposed. The second point is that although this counter-revolutionary war started in April of 2023, for the people of Darfur, it's really a continuation of a war that started in 2003. So it's been 20 years in the making. And the third very important point is that SAF and the RSF are part of the same coercive military apparatus. They have complementary and also compartmentalized specializations. And even though they have a rivalry, they also have a lot in common, primarily the complete disregard for international law. So the situation on the ground is that since April 2023, SAF has been conducting airstrikes in very densely populated residential areas. The RSF is known to loot people's homes, and we'll get into that, why looting homes and settling people's homes is part of their military tactic. They're also known to use rape as a weapon of war, and they've been utilizing anti-aircraft missiles against human beings. So if you can imagine the devastating effect of using weapons that are really built for machines, but using them on human beings.
And both sides have also been using starvation as a weapon of war, as documented by media and human rights organizations.
Yes, that is very true. Actually, both warring parties, they don't have any respect for international humanitarian law, and they use starvation as a weapon of war. Both of them are blocking aid supplies and making the situation, which is already very bad, making it worse by blocking aid coming from outside.
I think one organization based in The Hague predicted that as many as 2.5 million people in Sudan might die by the end of the year due to this use of starvation. And I say not simply as a weapon of war, but as a weapon of genocide as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Aziza. The humanitarian impact of all of this has been really catastrophic. Like, conservative estimates say that 15,000 people have been killed, but according to the U.S. Special Envoy, Tom Perello, that death count is probably closer to 150,000 people. And one of the devastating things about this war is that we actually don't have an accurate death count. The situation is just that bad. We do know that about 12 million people have been forced to flee their homes. To put that into perspective, that is more than the entire population of Greece. And of those, 10 million are internally displaced and 2 million sought refuge in neighboring countries, including Egypt, South Sudan, Chad, Ethiopia, Central African Republic, and Kenya. And part of the reason that people are fleeing their homes is because the RSF is showing up at people's doors and really forcing them out at gunpoint and looting their homes and occupying them. Why are they doing this? It's actually because they were brought to Khartoum from Darfur by Bashir's regime to counter the protesters during the revolution in 2019. And when the war began and when SAF utilized airstrikes against the RSF camps, which were on the outskirts of the city, these people no longer had homes. They had nowhere to go. They don't have connections in Khartoum. And like all human beings, they need shelter. They need somewhere to go. So they were actually instructed to loot people's homes. And that makes this a really intimate form of military occupation. And it's one of the RSF's trademark strategies. And it also, in some ways, resembles the settler colonial strategies that we're seeing in Gaza.
I wanted to add to what Umnia already mentioned about the humanitarian situation. And actually, I would like to tackle one aspect that people don't talk about a lot. The conflict in the Western media is largely depicted as tribal or a civil war. And there is climate change and extractive transnational economy component to these problems that people don't talk about. And the climate change component of it, actually, it is not something confined only to Sudan. It is something that impacting the entire Sahel region. Since 1970s, the frequency and intensity of drought increased tremendously, as we all know. And if we recall, the Ethiopian famine in the early 1980s was part of that. Famines all over this area also. So that led to what people call a conflict between farmers, mainly work in the agriculture, and the pastoral component, which is moving all year round after their cattle and livestock. So the intensity between these two groups led to what people call militarized ranching. And this militarized ranching is also driven by transnational economy, the increased demand for agricultural products, mainly animal protein from this area, from Sudan and Somalia, contributed to increased intensity of the conflict between farmers and nomads. And it happened to be that those farmers are mainly from African tribes, whereby the nomads from Arab tribes. So now portraying that conflict as something tribal between Arabs and nomads disguises this fact, the underlying conditions related to climate change are related to extractive transnational economy geared towards not subsistence, as it had been for a very long time, but geared towards export, mainly to the Gulf region.
Actually, you got to pretty much what I was going to ask you about. And one thing I would add is that we talked about how it is that Sudan and Africa in general is largely ignored. And one alibi or excuse is that it's natural. It's an African problem. The drought is a natural problem. I'd like us to talk about how these things are produced economically, politically, and to try to show how the international community itself is also complicit in part of the politics that drive these terrible acts of violence and extraction. We've learned in researching this about Russia's involvement through the Wagner Group, for example, but also the UAE and Israel. Could you talk a little bit about how what seems to the outside dismissible as a natural tribal or a famine produced by a drought actually is driven by both local and international political interests?
Actually, that's very true that those international influences and interests have a lot to do with the war going on in Sudan. Sudan is a country that is very rich in natural resources, and all those countries are competing to extract the natural resources of Sudan. So if we take, for example, the Gulf region and Gulf countries like UAE and Saudi Arabia, both of them are competing actually in Sudan for political and economic interests, diplomatic, political, and also economic stature in the country. Although they started aligned together against the revolution, but now they become all of a sudden rival because each one of them is trying to extend their influence and achieve their own specific interests in Sudan. Arabia is mainly interested in security of the Red Sea and also in extracting food resources from Sudan, and United Arab Emirates is mainly interested in gold and mineral resources and also in Sudan's ports. They have been trying to get a concession for establishing a new port in Sudan and also operating the national port, the old port, Port Sudan. And those are the interests that are behind the intervention of these two countries. When we talk about Russia, for example, Russia has been for a very long time interested in having logistical naval base in the Red Sea, and that is one of the main causes of their interference in Sudan using their paramilitary Wagner group.
I really would like to talk about how these connections between UAE and Saudi Arabia and Russia and their kind of interests in a form of economic imperialism and regional domination, how that's tied to the counter-revolutionary aspect of this war. So I think to do that, it's useful to talk about the aims of the Sudanese revolution of 2019, because all of these things are interconnected. So starting in December of 2018, there was an incredible, very peaceful, popular uprising in Sudan that I think many people saw images of that uprising. And it was spurred first off by increases in fuel and wheat subsidies, which we'll get to at some point. But one of the aims was to depose Omar al-Bashir, who at that point had been in power for 30 years and who was also facing 5 counts of crimes against humanity, including 2 counts of war and 3 counts of genocide at the International Criminal Court. There was a major sit-in that occurred in front of the military headquarters, and this was a really beautiful place for practicing liberation, community care, popular education, and it turned out that the security forces failed to disperse the masses, which was millions of people throughout Sudan. This was not like just youth or just leftists. It was like truly a popular uprising. And when they failed to disperse the masses, a lot of lower ranking military officers switched sides and they joined the protesters. And this kind of set of events ultimately led to al-Bashir's security committee staging a palace coup against the regime. And on April 11th, 2019, he was deposed. And after this, the military generals went ahead and they established a transitional military council. And they started negotiating the creation of an interim government with civilian representatives. And this government would then, after 4 years' time, organize democratic elections in what would have been 2023. What was clear to many people, and is even more clear now, is that they were never negotiating in good faith. The sit-in was really violently dispersed on June 3rd, 2019, in a very violent massacre. And despite these acts of violence, the people didn't give in, and the civilians had some really important asks. The implications of what they were asking for is very dangerous for places like the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia, who are deeply invested in maintaining military regimes, not only within Sudan, but they're also invested in preventing the rise of democracy within their own countries and within their own populations. So one of the main things that the civilians were saying is that they wanted a transition to a democratic system where there was no role for the military whatsoever, and the militia would be disbanded. They were from the beginning against SAF and the RSF, and they were also against any foreign intervention from the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, who, for the reasons I just said, have been really historically anti-democracy proponents inside of Sudan. While the revolution was a really hopeful time for people, it was also hijacked by both Sudanese opportunists and also by foreign powers that saw this as a perfect opportunity to interfere and secure their own interests. And the immediate trigger that led to the war was actually around the integration of the RSF militia into the official Sudanese armed forces. And it's also important to say that both of these generals came together in 2021 to jointly execute a coup against the civilian population. So the point here really being that the economic interests of these regional powers is really also tied up with their interests in preventing any kind of democracy in Sudan and in the region.
Actually, immediately after the revolution, United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, supported by United States and Britain, constituted what in Sudan we call the Quad. Actually, they call themselves all through that, the Quad. And together, those four countries pressed very hard for military-civilian partnership. Actually, the civilian part of this was just the facade. It wasn't like a real partnership. They were not equal participants behind the scenes. The military were the real power in that partnership. And actually, this failed policy enforced by those outside force ultimately led to the war, because all of them, four countries, they were against a genuine civilian transition in Sudan. And of course, the reasons, as said by Umnia, because they fear a true democratic system in Sudan that they cannot control, and they prefer to deal with military strongmen that they can bribe and coerce and just execute their policies in Sudan.
Reportedly, the UK now has been very actively shielding criticism of the UAE for its arming of the RSF and enablement of the continuing genocidal violence in Darfur and elsewhere. I think the point you made about how dangerous demilitarization of Sudan would have been to the extractive interests of all of these transnational parties involved speaks so strongly and clearly to the intrinsic connection between neocolonial capitalism and its dependence on violence to enforce its modes of extraction. And so far from the descriptions we constantly hear in Sudan, I think the most common word in headlines about Sudan is crisis. Sudan is represented as a perpetual, quote unquote, crisis. The very phrase perpetual crisis is an oxymoron. Something can't simultaneously be a crisis, which suggests an extreme emergence, a departure from the norm, and perpetual. But those two halves of the phrase together, perpetual and crisis, speak both to the permanent structural conditions that give rise to violence of capitalism, but simultaneously the way that it's constantly erased and rendered invisible. By calling it crisis, it means we don't need to think of it as structural. We can just dismiss it as something that's exceptional and a norm. But simultaneously, by calling it perpetual, we can dismiss it as being normalized, and therefore we don't have to pay attention to it. It's just the background ambient noise of our lives that continue as usual. But we know, far from being, as David described in these stereotypes of Sudan, almost like a colonial, quote unquote, backwater pervaded by tribal conflicts, we know that Sudan, in fact, has been a laboratory, a frontline for the development of new modes of colonial violence and subjugation and control from the very generation of politicized ethnic identities through colonial modes of divide and conquer, as documented by scholars like Mahmoud Mamdani, to being on the current front lines of the quote unquote war on terror and its new modes of militarized violence that it's inaugurated. So that even before 2001, some of the first counter-terror strikes and this discourse of the war on terror actually occurred in 1998 when Bill Clinton was speaking about the necessity of bombing an installment in Sudan, which turned out to be a pharmaceutical factory, the Ashifa factory, that produced such a high proportion of Sudan's medicines, yet was depicted as an Al-Qaeda facility that was bombed. No reparations ever given to Sudan for those. In fact, on the contrary, reparations have been extracted out of Sudan by the US to pay for their quote unquote terrorism. And so can you talk a bit about the new transnational and internationalist modes of violence that have been being developed in Sudan as a crucible of experimentation in colonial forms of violence?
It's a really great question, Aziza. And starting from the beginning of what you said about how the UK has been guarding the UAE from criticism, what's really interesting here is that the UAE and Saudi Arabia have made themselves completely indispensable to the UK and to the US, and are therefore able to enforce their geopolitical agenda. The US has a really long history of supporting military dictatorships, not only in Sudan, but across the African continent, starting with the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in 1960 and Kwame Nkrumah in 65. And those are just two examples. But from that period onwards, what the US and Europe have done is create a system where they can control politics and trade and war on the African continent through kind of neoliberal market logics. So the power dynamics have not changed. I want to answer your question about the frontier of modern warfare by talking about both proxy wars and by also talking about mineral extraction, because precious minerals are quite literally the raw material of militarized power. Without them, international superpowers wouldn't have the raw materials to create the instruments of war, from nuclear weapons to surveillance technologies to AI-based warfare and autonomous weapon systems. So any quest at global or regional domination really hinges on acquiring these minerals. And that gives us a bit of a clue about why these mines are some of the least regulated and most degraded places on Earth, and why they're also epicenters of militias and war. I think that this creation of this form of proxy warfare that we're seeing all across the African continent through non-governmental militias ends up being really tied to these precious minerals. So I just learned last week from Vijay Prashad, was on Democracy Now, and he was talking about the CIA's assassination of Patrice Lumumba was partially motivated by wanting access to the uranium in the Sinkalobwe mine in the DRC. And they were able to access that uranium and use it to create the nuclear weapons that were dropped Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And uranium from that same mine was also used by the State of Israel in 1968 in an effort to build up its nuclear war operations after the 67 Arab-Israeli war. We can also talk a little bit more about the Wagner Group, for example, which is Russia's paramilitary. They've been supporting the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces in Sudan, giving them weapons, giving them mercenaries, providing them with diplomatic coverage and also disinformation campaigns. And Abu Dhabi has been really secretive around its ties with the RSF, but we have evidence that shows the FMAT oversees Emirati interests in protecting gold mines that are under Wagner's control. And the gold that's extracted from these mines then passes through UAE before reaching Russia. The UAE, the RSF, and Russia's alliance through Wagner has been really strengthened after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, because they're aiming to bolster their gold reserve in relation to the U.S. sanctions, right? And the U.S. has also sanctioned two Femeti-linked gold sector companies. U.S. sanctions are another kind of weapon of U.S. imperialism. Outward facing, these sanctions are made to look as if they're some kind of disincentive against human rights violations when they're really a way for the United States to continue pushing its imperialistic agenda.
And I would like just to talk about the role of the international financial institutions of this world force, like the IMF, and how policies enforced by the IMF against the interest of the peoples in these countries has led, for example, the austerity measures have led to a lot of problems. The governments, this forced the governments to privatize everything from the army to the security apparatus. And this explains the rise of militias all over Africa, not only in Africa. Actually, this is now not only a regional phenomenon, but actually it is an international phenomenon we see in Africa and also in other places. Those measures gave rise to dependence on not national armies, but on militias.
For example, the Wagner Group, which I was mentioning, is known as AfriCorps in Africa, and they're all over the African continent. They have ties with the RSF, which has ties with the leadership in Chad, Ethiopia, Libya, Central African Republic, Kenya, and Israel. We see, for example, that these Israeli-made smart artillery missiles, LR-160s, are then being used all over the place, Georgia, Romania, Kazakhstan, Venezuela, but also in Sudan, and that Israel has been providing the RSF with really advanced communications and surveillance technology, and that both Hemeti and Al-Burhan have been trying to be allies of Israel. And it relates also to the Abraham Accords, the bilateral agreement that the United States is pushing to normalize Arab-Israeli relationships through trade, through military partnerships.
One note about the Wagner Group, and then I'd like to talk about IMF and the UN. It's actually the Wagner Group. It was named after Richard Wagner, and it was started by this sort of thug that insinuated himself into Putin's inner circle because he was catering all the dinners and soon it became a wealthy restaurateur that he took this veer into. It's inaccurate to call him a mercenary because it's state-sanctioned. It's like an ersatz wing of the Russian military. And so when you talk about Israel and Arab Israel things, the fact that it's named after Richard Wagner, proto-fascist, is one thing. But I wanted to talk about, you mentioned, Osman, the IMF, and the more I read about Sudan, the more the figure of the IMF, the World Bank, comes up as being so instrumental in price-fixing and essentially engineering famine in different ways to its interests. And Aziza will tell you, and you'll know from listening to our shows, we have a perennial critique of the United Nations. And this seems yet another instance where the United Nations has, in order to maintain some presence, has sided with the SAF. And then you mentioned earlier in the show about how both of the groups have taken international humanitarian aid and then just basically given it to their constituents, kept them in the city, and in a sense, negatively then created more this punishment by starvation. So I want to switch gears a bit because I also came across these remarkable stories of these networks of civil society. Mm-hmm. They're stepping in and feeding people. I think it's called the emergency response rooms. And earlier, Umnia talked about precisely this is the stifling and strangulation of civil society. Could you both talk a little bit about civil society and where you see its resilience, but also maybe give us a sense of how it is that there is such resilience and courage in the face of these insurmountable odds and the international community's complete failure?
Yeah, actually, these emergency response rooms are organized by the same civil resistance committees, which we call in Sudan resistance committees. The resistance committees were instrumental in staging protests, organizing protests and sit-ins, and have been protesting actually in 2018 for 6 months continuously till that ended with toppling of Omar al-Bashir. And after the war, Yazidi transformed from street activists into people providing essential lifeline for all the population, starting with providing food, collecting donations, also providing people who would like just to flee and they don't know how to do that, helping them fleeing danger. And for sick people and elderly, they tried to provide also facilitate medical care. So they have been doing a phenomenal job in providing support that all these NGOs and aid agencies, United Nations aid agencies, couldn't provide. And actually now they receive widespread recognition from all people who are working in the humanitarian field.
There's a United Nations report that literally calls the emergency response rooms, they say they're operating in states across the country, functioning like a, quote, local emergency government. So where there has been a complete failure of the state and of the international organizations that are supposed to step in and provide basic humanitarian aid or protect people from militias and genocidal violence, they have failed to do. But I think in the absence of all of that, people have showed up and created the alternative themselves. And when we look at the emergency response rooms, young people across Sudan are modeling a new way of thinking about humanitarianism that is much more grassroots. It is decentralized. There's not some central organization. They're not taking any kind of orders. They're just responding to the needs around each other. And I really like the portion of the question about where does this resilience come from? Sudanese people have a very long history of resisting colonialism, resisting dictators, and surviving under harsh conditions, and yet within an ethos that I think is not yet completely dominated by neoliberal logics. People are functioning in different kinds of relations to each other, and it's quite beautiful. It's very inspiring. There's incredible art coming out of Sudan. There's emergency response rooms that are putting on theater shows for children. They're not just dealing with how do we feed people, but they're also filling in for the absence of schools. There's 19 million children in Sudan who are out of school. There are 23,000 schools that have been completely obliterated or are inaccessible. And Sudan's population is already, I believe, around 50% are under the age of 18. So when you think about these tremendous numbers of children who are out of schools, I think it's devastating. This is why the situation in Sudan is being called a complete failure of humanity. And I wonder about these children because they're just growing up in a different world from, for example, the people who are providing these emergency responses to them, who maybe had their own hardships, but did not have a complete failure of all systems.
I think that this vitiation of the conditions for social reproduction is something we're seeing so heartbreakingly across so many situations of genocide, from the Rohingya to the Palestinians. And yet it's not encompassed within dominant notions of what genocide are, which are very narrowly focused on questions of physical killing, usually, and prioritizing that. I want to return to this question of resistance because, as you've said, there are so many beautiful and largely unknown histories of resistance in Sudan that really challenge so many of the dominant parameters and ways of thinking about what resistant agency. But first, can we dissect and diagnose more deeply the failure, the absolute failure of these international institutions in Sudan when it comes to organizations like the UN on our podcast before, as David mentioned, but also emerging from the UN's own reports in context after context, whether in Sri Lanka or in Myanmar, the same issues of the UN's inability and, in fact, complicity and upholding of the most atrocious situations has been revealed as something that's not accidental or, again, a quote-unquote crisis, but something that's deeply endemic to the institution, whether it be colluding with atrocity-laden governments or obfuscating the situation. Alex DeWall in the London Review of Books the other day wrote that the UN will probably avoid using the word famine with respect to Sudan, not because the situation doesn't merit the word famine, but simply due to political considerations, not wanting to alienate Al-Burhan, the head of the Sudanese armed forces, who the UN has recognized as the head of state of Sudan, despite the violence that he himself has been involved with. In some ways, it seems like even the very official international peacekeeping processes have served to further empower violent actors by not including the people on the ground who are providing the humanitarian support to people, but rather empowering parties that are warring with each other. In other words, acting as if the only people who can make peace are those who are making war, not the people who are actually seeding peace on the ground. And so can you both talk a bit more about what exactly have been the failings of international institutions in Sudan? And do you see these as something that is just a result of flawed implementation that could be fixed? Or is it something deeper to do with the way these institutions function and have been constituted in the first place?
I would say, actually, it has to do with the latter. This system is proving day after day how dysfunctional it has become. And also, at the same time, countries with very deep pockets like United Arab Emirates are using very sinister ways or means to influence these international UN organizations and the UN itself. For example, now it is very rare to read or to listen to anybody mentioning UAE by name and highlighting the role it plays in this conflict. And part of this could be explained by those officials in these organizations lending themselves to bribery and being influenced by countries like United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia.
A great example of United Nations collusion that I did want to talk about is the situation that we're seeing unfolding in Haiti. Haiti has been under quasi-US occupation since 2004, right after the democratically elected president at the time had requested or suggested the idea of getting some kind of reparations from France. And what the United States is trying to do right now, not only have they used the UN to put UN soldiers into Haiti for a long time now, but the U.S. is also turning to recruiting Kenyan soldiers to do their dirty bidding. And of course, not incidentally, Kenya is one of the largest recipients of U.S. aid. So I think we can just see how all of these things are connected. Yeah. And I also wanted to say that Haiti has been under occupation since the coup d'etat, and the U.S. has instituted their own people, two of their own leaders in that country. So we see the linkages between U.S. economic exploitation, the highly profitable military industrial complex, and how organizations like the United Nations play into both of those.
What is going on now in Sudan is a testimony to this failure, not naming the real actors behind a lot of the sufferings that are taking place in Sudan, being totally dysfunctional and unable to provide help and support for those in need. And actually, the aid they provided, as mentioned by David, ended up in the hands of the two warring parties using this aid as a mean of genocide.
Can you, because Dr. Osman, your specific area of specialty is forestry. When it comes to the ecological devastation as well, have these international institutions, which we know have been so lacking when it comes to any form of ecological redress for colonial and neocolonial forms of violence, when it comes specifically to the ecological dimension that you were speaking about earlier, do you see those same structural failures unfolding in Sudan?
Actually, we see the interconnections between all these, the dwindling of the natural resource base and the conflict. And we have those huge UN organizations with very big names, UNDP, and all of them try to portray themselves as working in this front, trying to taming degradation and establishing reforestation programs. But at the same time, that hasn't yielded like any results. What we see now all over Africa, a country like United Arab Emirates buying vast etwa of land, trying to use what they called carbon credit and buying lands in countries like Mozambique and Zambia and all over, either establishing mono instead of the natural forest in dominating the natural tree cover found in these countries. And so this is to benefit United Arab Emirates and United Nations, and the entire international community have nothing to say or to do again. So what we see now, these new middle powers like Saudi Arabia, but in particular United Arab Emirates, buying a lot of land, driving farmers and land users from these lands and using it for their own purposes, trying, of course, to diversify their economies away from fossil fuel and securing their food needs in these countries without benefiting the land users in these countries.
And then arming groups like the RSF who are going and very intentionally attacking and burning down agricultural lands as also a weapon in this war. The summer harvest has just failed in Sudan due to both people being driven away from their lands, but also these same militias that are armed by the same folks he's talking about, UAE, Saudi Arabia, going through and burning agricultural land in order to create a situation that sediments, for example, the UAE's ability to then take more land, buy more land, deforest that land, and use it for their own kind of purposes, their own economies.
Aziz, I think you had a second part to your question, right? You want to talk more about resistance. Did you want to pose that again?
So maybe I can just say the few things that I would still be interested in knowing more about. So first, whether the left here has an analysis adequate to address these multifarious forms of neocolonialism now arising, in which it's not just a US-centric issue, but it's also about all of these other players such as Russia and UAE behaving in a colonial and extractive fashion. And yet we see this like visceral defense of Russia in some sections on the left as supposedly an anti-imperialist force. And so do you think that current accounts of imperialism and neocolonialism in the leftist spaces that you're familiar with, are they adequate to address the sources and roots of what we are seeing happening in Sudan right now?
I think not at all. The situation is truly very complex. We don't live in the 1960s anymore. Empire is...
I think you need to tell that to the tankies. Hello, we don't live in the 1960s anymore. 1960s call, they want their politics back.
I really often feel like that's where many people's analysis is stuck, is in a 1960s mindset. But since then, we've had the neoliberal kind of destabilization of the gold standard, which has completely changed the game globally, putting the US as the top global power. But the US is, like you said, their relationships with countries like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, these are not small powers. And so I think even our terminology that we have, we have not developed a new lexicon that allows us to think beyond a global north and a global south. You have very strong, very dangerous imperial powers that are making really big moves on the global kind of playing board. And especially in the United States, I think it's not well understood. And For a lot of different reasons, I think there are folks who even understand a little bit more who are hesitant to criticize countries like the United Arab Emirates, but
Russia.
And Russia. So yeah, I don't think that the leftist understanding of the world that we're living in has quite caught up to what is happening. And I think it's really important to explain it. I don't think it's simple, right? I'm not necessarily blaming people because it's a really complex global situation, and it requires study in a way that, for example, part of the reason that I think it's much easier to garner support for the genocide that we're seeing happen in Gaza is that it's a really simple situation in many ways. There's two actors. We know absolutely what is right and what is wrong. When you get into the deeper complexities of how modern power works, how warfare works, yeah, I think it's difficult for people to grasp, and a lot of people are not necessarily interested in renewing their political worldview.
I think it is very oversimplified view to consider to have this limited analysis that doesn't include also the role of countries like Russia, China, or even trying to portray these countries as allies of the left in some circles, and defending also their politics, and which is not different from the same extractive economic model that has been applied by imperial powers for a very long time. So we need to develop a new thinking about the role of these powers and also the newly emerging powers in the Middle East, including the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, and how they are acting now as the new force in this area, exploiting African countries and also even countries like Egypt now, in order just to guarantee that Egypt stays neutral in this conflict in Sudan. United Arab Emirates is pledging to pay an amount of, they said, $35 billion to invest that amount of money in Egypt. And doing that will enable them to just neutralize Egypt totally, because Egypt is mainly considered now about their economic problems. So this very huge financial power of United Arab Emirates makes it a very important player in the region. And as already mentioned, a power that made itself indispensable even for United States and for Britain, as we have seen how Britain is trying just to shield United Arab Emirates from any criticism. And actually, when Sudan, the government raised a complaint about UAE intervention in the war in Sudan, and Britain tried to have an independent position, immediately, United Arab Emirates suspended high-level ministerial meetings with Britain, and those meetings were supposed to discuss Marathi investments in Britain. And immediately after that, we saw this change that Britain started defending and also trying to shield United Arab Emirates from criticism in the United Nations.
So against these very simplistic geographies of power that we see being projected, we also know, looking to Sudanese history, that there are so many geographies that exceed the imagination of colonial understandings. For example, reading about Sudanese history, we know that cities like Omdurman historically were a site where Palestinians and people from all over the world came, refuting this idea that the only cosmopolitanism or transnational connections are those that are conducted on colonial terms. So I'm wondering, what can we learn then from Sudanese histories, including Sudanese histories of resistance, in not only resisting the forms of violence that we see, but in developing a conceptualization and a framework adequate for even understanding them in the first place. Looking at Sudanese histories of resistance, we see how they defy and complicate so many dominant ideas about what resistance looks like, at least from a dominant colonial perspective. For example, the role of Sufis in anti-colonial resistance historically, to the very prominent central role of women in the more recent Sudanese revolutions, completely dismantling any concept that Black Muslim women lack agency and are simply passive objects of history rather than people who are making history themselves. I think, Dr. Osman and Omnia, you're our first father-daughter team that we've ever had on the podcast before. And so also seeing this intergenerational transfer of the knowledge that's necessary to deconstruct systems of violence is also a beautiful thing. And so can you talk a bit about how essential it is to retrieve and these histories emerging from Sudan of ways of resisting violence that exceed colonial imaginaries of the present?
Yeah, actually, as you already mentioned, Aziza, Sudan's history has been very unique in this respect. As we know, at the end of the 19th century, the Mahdi revolution was the first revolution to defeat an imperial power like Britain at that time and establish a national system of government. And one of the things that complicates struggle for democratization in Sudan is that Sudan was one of the first countries that achieved its independence in Africa. And compared to all neighboring countries, even Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and so we have politically very developed population, people who value democracy, and we fight against dictatorship. So Sudan has a lot to provide in that respect. If there is one thing that unites them, despite the rivalry concerning some issues, they are, all of them are united in fighting any kind of democratic transformation in Sudan because they perceive that as something endangering their despotic archaic systems in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and also the long-standing dictatorship in Egypt. And in other African countries, like in Uganda, Ethiopia, Eritrea, all these countries. And I mean, there is a lot that can be learned from this Sudanese experience and revolutionary traditions.
I would love to answer your question about thinking about the future. And I think when there's an awful destructive war like this, that we don't know what the end of this current situation is, that sometimes we forget to talk about the future. I would like to do just that. And maybe I'll start with mutual aid and solidarity are really strong and have very deep histories in Sudan. The word mutual aid became very popular in the United States, at least, I believe, with COVID and the second wave of Black Lives Matter, which happened in 2020. But in Sudan, these forms of solidarity and resource distribution are literally part of the fabric of our society. So I want in a moment to encourage people to support different organizations. And we can say the names of those organizations because although we might not be able to completely upend the system of global hegemony all at once, what we can do is we can redistribute our resources. We can give money that can save lives. And this is something that no state, no military can take away from us as regular people who are on the other side of the world. We keep coming back to this issue of U.S. imperialism and these other hegemonic powers. And I think we truly need a new 21st century anti-imperialist politic and also a strategy for achieving, for resisting these powers, which are stronger than they've ever been. We're living quite literally in the most sophisticated system of global domination that has ever existed. Our task is enormous, both in the sense of providing immediate relief and life-saving humanitarian aid to people that are being targeted by these same entities that some of us are living inside of, right? I'm speaking from inside the United States of America. And we also need a more kind of long-term critical and strategic plan. And so when we think about the situation in Sudan, I think beyond the humanitarian aid, which is very immediately something that is needed, we also need an immediate ceasefire. And that requires concerted peacemaking efforts, halting the inflow and trade of weapons, sanctioning the RSF and its auxiliary networks like Wagner in the UAE. We need to create ways to protect the people that are in immediate danger of ethnic cleansing and of genocidal violence. And there's something we forgot to mention about, there's a single city, maybe you can speak to it, where in one day, 10,000 to 15,000 people of a single ethnic group were killed. In one city, in one day.
Yes, actually, this was in West Darfur, the westernmost city in Darfur called the Jinena. And within just one day or a few days, the RSF killed, according to reports, between 10 to 15,000 people from one ethnic group, the Masalit group. And actually, this number is a huge undercount because eyewitness in a Jinena puts that number close to 22,000, not only between 10 and 15. And they forced 500,000 people to flee from their homes and into Chad. So this has been aided and abetted by United Arab Emirates, who provided weapons for and is still providing weapons and not only diplomatic and political coverage for this aggression from United Arab Emirates. Not only weapons, but also providing mercenaries from neighboring countries. It has been actually a very grim situation in that part of Darfur. And this is not the fairest ethnic cleansing perpetrated by RSF. It is just a continuation. This is the second round of ethnic cleansing. This round of ethnic cleansing, which took place in the beginning of actually is repeated exactly in a more stronger way, in a more devastating way. And still there is no any form or any accountability has been achieved for the first round of ethnic cleansing and, of course, for this second ongoing ethnic cleansing.
So when we think about the present and the future, I think this question of how do we provide protection to people that are in immediate danger, that, you know, a tribe, an ethnic group that in one day 20,000 people can be taken out. The women and the girls are experiencing really unprecedented amounts of sexual violence because this is one of the RSF's tactics. And we also really need to advocate for safe corridors for humanitarian aid to be delivered safely, because right now, both sides of this conflict, the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces, are both obstructing the delivery of humanitarian aid, just as we're seeing with the Israeli military in Gaza. But I think in a more long-term sense, the Sudanese people continue to a desire and struggle for a full transition to a civilian democratic rule one day in Sudan. And I think once the ceasefire is in place, there have to be coordinated initiatives to support a peaceful transition to civilian rule, to begin the process of disarming soldiers, rehabilitating survivors of war, rebuilding infrastructure that includes the medical, education, and agriculture sectors. Right now, more than 70% of medical facilities in Sudan are completely destroyed. And people are dying from outbreaks of very curable diseases like malaria and cholera, including my cousin, who was very young, a young girl, who died of malaria late last year, which is a very curable disease. But it just goes to show when you have militias and militaries that are bombing hospitals and medical facilities, it's not just the immediate death count. It's also they are obstructing people from life-saving care. And I think ultimately we have to think about establishing stability and true self-determination, not only in Sudan, but across Africa. And for me, I think it really is going to take a concerted kind of pan-Africanist effort. And what's exciting is that we are actually seeing right now what I think is a wave of anti-imperialist resistance in Niger, in Senegal, in the Congo, African countries who are talking about delinking their economies from the franc. Is that correct, Mali?
In the case of Senegal, they are now calling for delinking their economy from the franc.
And the ones who kicked out the U.S. military? Was that?
Yeah, actually in Niger and Chad, they, both of them, the U.S. AFRICOM soldiers, Pentagon forces stationed in these countries have been driven out from both countries. In April, that took place in...
You said Niger?
In Niger and...
Niger and Chad. Does Niger, but Niger has the drone bases as well, right? But so are those being dismantled? Is it all military presence or it's just the soldiers on the ground? Or?
I'm not sure about the base itself, but the soldiers on the ground have been driven out of from both countries, from Niger and also from Chad in April and May.
Oh, this year, yeah. So I think...
That's awesome.
These are very exciting developments that are occurring. To go back to your earlier question, it seems like people here in this part of the world are not quite aware of the significance of nations that have been for hundreds of years completely oppressed and their resources extracted, their people killed, as we're continuing to see. And to this day, there are about 7 million people enslaved in Africa. We don't talk much about modern day slavery, but it's continuing in Africa and it's continuing in Africa for a reason. But I wanted to continue the point about the future in Sudan. I think one of the other really crucial things is that we have to absolutely prevent these military criminals from being able to participate in any kind of future political proceedings. They have to be completely banned. This is really crucial. So once the war is stopped, Hemeti, Al-Burhan, these high-ranking military officers, they should never be allowed into any room, into any political proceedings, because they are war criminals. And we also would like to see them tried in the International Criminal Court and sentenced, because unfortunately, we live in a world where high-ranking people can get away with committing genocide. And, you know, that lack of accountability on a transnational systemic level, I think it emboldens people to commit these kinds of acts.
And actually, that goes against United Nations and also United States, Britain, those regional force, United Arab Emirates, plans to reinstitute the same criminals again. So what they are talking about now is stopping the war and bringing those rival generals together. And nobody is talking about just not allowing them to form the future government in Sudan. So the model, the plan is to bring them back to rule as in a new form of a partnership between the military, the militia. And again, just repeating the same experiment of military-civilian partnership, which has been the cause of this war and all the sufferings and all the destructions that ensued.
The genesis for this episode was Umni and I were at a Palestine event many months ago, and you said, Umni, people should know more about Africa. And then about... I think 4 weeks later, there was a big demonstration at White Plaza. I there's a bunch of signs saying Gaza, Sudan, Congo, don't forget. So I took a photograph and I texted it to you immediately as if they had heard you say that. This is a small beginning. I'm wondering if you could tell us which news sources in English would be best for our audience to learn about. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about news sources and authors and books that you'd like our audience to know about. And the second thing is that we have a blog for our website, and we invite you both to blog for us and to include these links, but also use it as a way to file op-eds and to put the word out this way. And you also have a completely open door to this podcast whenever you want it. But maybe you could talk now, just to close us off, on not only news sources, but also organizations that we might contribute to.
Yeah, thank you, David. I would like to highlight just four organizations that we want to encourage people to donate to and connect with that are doing incredible work on the ground. One is the Darfur Women's Action Group, SAPA, the Sudanese American Physicians Association, the Sudan Solidarity Collective, and the Sudan Doctors Union. And I have links for all of these. Maybe we can post them with
Absolutely.
This episode. Those are just, there's many other initiatives, but those are some of the main ones, the big ones. EyesOnSudan.net is a resource that gets updated quite often, and they have information for connecting people to organizations they can donate to, contacting their representatives, funding, finding volunteer opportunities, or even resources for starting a fundraiser or hosting displaced Sudanese people, because there are many people in need of homes. So I also just want to say that the collective pressure of the petition seems to be working on some level, because a growing number of Democrats are demanding that Biden suspend weapons sales to the UAE unless it stops arming the RSF. Those calls have not amounted to anything. The administration has not taken any steps, but there is pressure from U.S. Government representatives. I'll let you talk about if there's other sources you recommend for people to learn more about what's going on.
Actually, there is a new book forthcoming about Sudan and South Sudan wars. I don't recall the name of the author right now, but I can provide that later, maybe.
Yes, you can just send us a resource list, like just a list of links to organizations and news sources and forthcoming books or anything that's helpful for people to get a better grounded analysis and continuing information.
Yeah, we can definitely.
Also, deepest condolences for your cousin. So sorry. That's heartbreaking.
It's really heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking. I think it's really heartbreaking when it's young people and it's malaria. I've had malaria 3 times. It's a very curable disease. You just need access to medical facilities and medicine. I was talking to her sister yesterday, my cousin, and they don't have access to clean water. And that's the case across much of Sudan. But she's telling me that, yeah, the water they're drinking is brown. It's completely brown. The amount of diseases and parasites that people can get just from not having access to clean water and having no way to get it.
You know, speaking of left problems in discourse, we also need to stop speaking of these lives as ungrievable lives. They're not. I'm grieving for your cousin. These lives are deeply grieved. They're only ungrievable within a context that normalizes the white gaze and its disregard of everyone outside of it.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating to just be continually in a position of trying to get people to care even the smallest bit about what's happening in Sudan. It seems like the entire African continent has just been relegated as a place of like perpetual conflict and war, as you said earlier, and people just do not care. Even the people that you would think would care a little bit don't seem to have any interest. And it's eye-opening in a sense to just how messed up the world we live in is right now. And it's just, it's completely frustrating to say these numbers and to know that it doesn't mean anything to the person that's receiving it. I think being in the United States of America is really interesting in the sense I'm always talking about Sudan. I'm always talking about many conflicts that are happening around the world, but it's really clear that many Americans do not understand what war is. On a very fundamental level, they have no reference point to understand what it is and what this country, the impact, the havoc that it's wreaking on the entire world. So I think we have to think about closing that cognitive gap somehow, because we need these people that for whatever reason are not able to grasp, or are not, I don't know if it's an issue of ability, but seem not to be grasping the magnitude of what is happening in the world, the magnitude of human suffering that is unnecessary suffering, that is suffering for economic gain, suffering for regional and global dominance. So I don't know how to wake people up to the sanctity of life, and that life is extremely vulnerable. All lives are extremely vulnerable.
Thank you very much, actually, because the conflict in Sudan has been very deprioritized. And so this podcast is very important, giving us an opportunity to talk about some aspects of what is going on in Sudan, explain some of the connections, and trying to shed light on real causes of the conflict in Sudan. We are very thankful. I am very grateful for inviting me.
So, yeah, very grateful to both of you.
Please take a moment to like this episode and subscribe to this podcast. This will help bring it to other people's attentions. You might also follow me on Twitter at Palumbo Liu, and let us know about any subjects you would like us to cover or people or groups you'd like us to interview.